Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada. I'm a perimenopausal mama to my toddler named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Toni Reed. I'm a naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Alberta. And I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider. Welcome back, everyone, on this episode of the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast. It's myself, Dr. Toni, and Dr. Lisa. We're here to talk about sleep. Now, we've talked about sleep before on one of our earliest episodes. I think it was episode number 4 we talked about sleep. And so since then, we definitely have an update on some information that we want to share with all of you, because, again, we're still in the pandemic. I don't know about all of you out there, but again, your sleep may have been disrupted by the pandemic. Your sleep may be disrupted by a change in, you know, your schedule, your lifestyle, having kids. And, you know, as we get older, our sleep tends to be a little bit more fragile. And, you know, we can talk a little bit, we're going to definitely talk more about, you know, the benefits of sleep, what your sleep should look like, and how to get the best sleep possible. But it's really, I think, key for everyone to know that, you're not alone if you're having sleep issues. There's, you know, I think the latest stat is 2/3 of all people in developed nations are not getting at least 8 hours a night of sleep. And that has an impact on our bodies, Lisa, physically, mentally, and emotionally.
Definitely. If we get more sleep, we actually are going to live longer. So that expression, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead. Well, you might as well sleep so you'll stay alive longer, right? It's sometimes a badge of honor to say, you know, oh, I got 6 hours sleep and I could thrive. But they have so many studies now to show how it prevents diseases. Like, for example, if you're not getting enough sleep or poor sleep, it more than doubles your risk of heart disease, of cardiovascular disease. And we know diabetes is becoming a big epidemic. And otherwise, healthy people, when they don't get enough sleep, they can appear pre-diabetic on their blood tests, even just after a few nights of poor sleep. So they're going to increase their risk of diabetes. And then I think, you know, you probably noticed this, Toni, too, and myself, as well as many of my patients, when we don't get enough sleep or good quality sleep, you crave more sugar, you crave more carbohydrates, because that's a quick source of energy. And that makes your insulin soar, and it takes actually longer, 40% longer, to regulate your blood sugar after you've had a poor night's sleep. And that insulin also contributes to weight gain in the midsection. So these are some shocking statistics on what not getting enough sleep can do for you.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm sure other people out there may have also experienced this, happening where you don't get a good sleep, and it impacts your brain function. It impacts your ability to problem solve. It also impacts your mood and your energy, your ability to really kind of regulate your emotions. And that's important when you're dealing with your kids and dealing with partners and dealing with work and all of these things. You know, when you're sleeping, you're more creative, better at problem solving, and have a better memory, feel happier overall. Definitely studies have shown that, you know, with 6 hours or less of sleep, it really does impact your ability to think. But even there's research showing that less than 7 hours really starts to create those issues for your brain. Also, again, we get into more of that fight or flight mode, that survival mode, where our stress hormones increase, our cortisol increases, and that can really contribute to feeling more anxiety and getting into a vicious cycle of feeling wired and tired.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So it impacts everything from our head to our toes. So we talked about the heart, the like diabetes risk being increased, your weight, because you actually release more of the hormone ghrelin. We've talked about that before. When you don't get enough sleep, it's like the ghrelin hormone that makes you feel hungrier. And you even usually can eat up to 300 more calories a day when you're not getting enough sleep either, which can translate into an extra 10 to 15 pounds a year. So many trainers now, personal trainers, are recommending that people really amp up and focus on their sleep, or else their, you know, goals for fitness and strength and maintaining a healthy weight are going to be thwarted. You almost can't, you can't undo a poor night of sleep, or, you know, a chronic streak of poor sleep. It's really hard to make up for that.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's not like a bank where you can, you know, get a poor night's sleep and just make up for it the next night. That really, I wish this wasn't how it works. But it just really is the case where that doesn't happen. And we can't, you know, recoup some of the losses of, you know, one night's sleep, you know, the next night or even the next few nights. Not only, again, you know, in terms of our weight and metabolism, but even, you know, our immune system. And of course, this is important when we're dealing with a pandemic and we're dealing with viruses. You know, if you're getting less than 6 hours of sleep a night, you are not only more likely to be impacted by viruses, you know, it can be the common cold or other viruses. And you can even, you know, double your risk of getting cancer as well, because that immune system activity and balance is really key that way.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And then looking at the impacts on the brain too. So we do become more emotionally reactive when we haven't had enough sleep. Our amygdala is kind of that primitive area of the brain. And when we don't get enough sleep or good quality, we don't really have that filter or the communication from what's called the prefrontal cortex, which kind of like down regulates that response to stress or to anger or fear. So I think, you know, as parents, we can notice that too. If I don't get enough sleep, I can be more snappy, more short, more emotional for sure. And then they do recognize with sleep, it's a time for our body to heal and repair. So it's a time where it can undo some of the damages that accumulated over the day. But it's also a time for our brain to clean itself out. There's something called the glymphatic system. So it's like the lymphatic system, which is in our body. That's, you could make it kind of like talk about it like a sewage system of the body, where it cleans out our wastes. And then it's also a conduit for our immune cells. But that glymphatic system in our brain during sleep, it helps to clear it out, even clearing things out like amyloid plaques and substances that can trigger or cause inflammation and contribute to dementia too. So people that even had one night of 4 hours sleep, they had significantly more amyloid plaque in their brain, because this lymphatic system wasn't clearing things out properly.
And that's really scary when we think about aging. We really want to support our brain health and to, again, reduce dementia. And this is also, you know, that idea of our brain function too. When people get less sleep, or even, you know, when we're talking about like something like the dreaded daylight savings time changes it does impact the increased risk of accidents that people get into. There's more car accidents after, you know, changes when you lose an hour of sleep with the daylight savings time change. Even, you know, especially, you know, if you're getting less than 5 hours of sleep, you are three times more likely to crash your car. That kind of drowsiness causes more accidents than drugs or alcohol. And yet it isn't necessarily something that we talk about, or there isn't a large public service movement to reduce this kind of fatigue that we're experiencing from, you know, sleep issues and sleep deprivation.
Yeah, that daylight savings time, right, is really harmful, not only to our risk of accidents and our cognition, but there's actually a 24% increase in heart attacks right after the daylight savings time in spring, just by losing an hour. So just think about too, when you go to sleep on the weekends, are you getting more sleep, less sleep? Are you going to bed later? So, you know, I always think of if we're going to bed a few hours later on the weekend, it's like we've traveled to a different time zone, and then we expect to normalize on a Sunday night. I see so many patients that have issues with sleep on Sunday night because they've lost that natural sleep rhythm, that regular bedtime, regular wake time. But we'll talk about that a little bit more down the road. And as you mentioned, Tony, yeah, we can't make up for that sleep debt. Although naps, there is a time and a place, right? Especially as a new mom and when you're woken up multiple times in the night by your kids. They did a study in the 1990s. Well, NASA did a study, and they showed that even a 26-minute nap could increase your alertness by 50%. And increase performance on a task by 34%. But if you're getting, you know, ideally it's a monophasic sleep where you're in bed for, you know, sleeping for ideally 7 to 9 hours, and hopefully not needing a nap. But of course, with different phases of your life, you may need to get it when you can, right? So what is a good night's sleep anyway, Tony?
Absolutely. That's a great question, right? And again, you know, our patients are always asking, you know, how much should I be sleeping a night? What is a good night's sleep? What's ideal? Am I getting enough? How do you know whether you're getting enough? Definitely with the research, you know, and everyone's a little bit different, you know, everyone will have kind of different set points of exactly how many hours of sleep a night is really ideal for all of that restoration and repair to happen overnight. A ballpark range from research is generally anywhere from 7 to 9 hours a night. So I really think of kind of 7 hours as a really absolute minimum, because a lot of averages are leaning more to 8 or even sometimes 8.5 hours a night. And what's really key is not just, you know, spending, you know, 8 hours in bed. You really want to make sure that you're getting that 8 hours or aiming for 8.5 hours of time that you're actually sleeping. So especially the shorter amount of time that you can fall asleep, the better. You really want to be looking at falling asleep within 20 minutes. And waking up, you know, you could wake up, you know, 0 times a night, or you could wake up several times a night, but the really key is whether you're really able to fall back asleep easily. And having the ability to wake up before your alarm goes off, and not having to depend on an alarm. When we're talking about, you know, the length of time, that's important. But it can also make a difference for each person, you know, when you are falling asleep. And you know, having 8 hours for some people, and this is where talking about chronotypes is really interesting. You know, there's an idea that we have different types, and each of us as an individual have a more ideal time that we're sleeping, whether it's, you know, about almost 50% of people are more morning types, where they do really thrive and their bodies thrive by going to sleep earlier and waking up earlier. Maybe about a third of people are more evening types, where ideally going to sleep later and waking up later is more ideal. So it's definitely something to keep in mind. But a real question is asking yourself, like, you know, are you getting enough, and how do you know whether you're getting enough? If you're waking up in the morning, could you fall back asleep in a couple of hours? Could you have a nap around 10 or 11 a.m.? I know for myself, that's definitely a sign that's popped up, where if I'm feeling like I need a nap, it means that I didn't get enough sleep during the night. Can you function without any caffeine? You know, that's a big question for a lot of moms up there. Do you need your alarm to wake up? Or again, those of us with kids, we may have our kids as our alarm.
They can be our alarm. So then timing your bedtime to correspond to, okay, how many hours do I need? Like, what time do I need to get into bed so that I'm getting enough hours sleep before the kids wake up? Because for sure, when Stuart was an infant, I was known to be in bed at 8:30 or 9 because I knew of all the wake up times in the early mornings, I wasn't going to get, you know, 6 hours, or, you know, I wanted to get 8 hours, but I was lucky if I got 6 hours even doing that because the feedings were taking so long and the pumping sessions. So your chronotype can change over time. Sometimes it's forced. Sometimes it happens as you get older, because I used to be the night owl. Now I'm a morning lark. So I am a more of a morning person, but I'm not going to bed at 8:30 or 9 now, but really tapping into your body and adjusting your schedule accordingly based on kids and work routines is really important as well. And then sleep cycles are actually approximately 90 minutes. So you really, sometimes you actually do kind of wake up between sleep cycles, but you might not know. So, you know, it is normal to kind of wake up. But as you said, Tony, it's important that you just fall back asleep pretty easily and it doesn't take too long. And they're saying now too, like when you wake up, if you're lying in bed for more than 15, 20 minutes and you can't fall back asleep, they're really recommending, especially in the cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, CBTI, that you get out of bed, you do something boring so you get sleepy, and then you go back to bed when you're sleepy, so that you really associate the time being in bed with sleeping, not being associated with tossing and turning and not sleeping, because our brains can remember that. And then it becomes the, oh, I wake up in the night to go pee and now I'm going to lie here for an hour because that's what I did last night and the night before. So there's some hacks you can do that way. I'm not trained in CBTI or cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, but there's many psychologists who are, and that's one of the tenets out there to really focus on if you do wake up.
Absolutely. So I mean, there are different reasons why we would wake up. You know, there are ways that we would be stimulated to get up. We kind of have our circadian clock. We have our inner timekeeper. And that is, you know, temperature dependent, enzyme dependent, light dependent. So, you know, sunrise, sunset, light, you know, we do have receptors that will pick up on light in our environment. So, you know, that's definitely something to kind of keep in mind of what's going to wake you up. Then there's also, again, we really have that natural rhythm of not only our melatonin, our sleep hormone, which a lot of people know about, you know, that melatonin's made in our pineal gland, and it really is triggered by darkness to release that melatonin, and that light will stop that melatonin release. But that melatonin signal also really depends on our stress hormones. Our stress hormone cortisol has a natural daily circadian rhythm where it's highest in the morning, lowest at night. And when it's low, that will stimulate our melatonin to again be released and really help to support that sleep. But also, again, all of those other restorative processes that happen during sleep as well.
For sure. That's so key. So things like seeing daylight, you know, opening the blinds, and then, you know, in the morning, getting outside for daylight if possible, and then really dimming the lights before you go to bed, using red light bulbs in the bedrooms or the washrooms, so that we're not overriding this natural sunrise, sunset, because who, you know, stays inside all day, or maybe they work in their basement or they have no windows. And then at night, all the lights are on and they're on all these devices and screens. And we know that blue light will impact your melatonin production. So no wonder there's so many sleep issues, right? With technology, with working remotely and working so many more hours, we're not necessarily getting outside as much. So that cortisol melatonin rhythm is key. And then there's something else that helps control our sleep as like an overarching control, is something called adenosine. So this is what's called an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So a hormone in the brain that downregulates processes that tell our body that we're awake. So we wake up in the morning, ideally we see light, cortisol, you know, is not really, like, it's starting to increase. So because we see the light, the melatonin is shut down, and then adenosine starts to accumulate in our body. And it's a substance or neurotransmitter that makes us feel drowsy. So as the day goes on, it should get in high, high levels so that when it's bedtime, we're ready to go to sleep. We're tired. But things that can set back or influence that adenosine are things like caffeine from green tea, black tea, coffee, soft drinks, chocolate. So the structure of a substance in there looks like adenosine, and it blocks your adenosine from working. So you're not going to accumulate as much adenosine. It's not going to have the same effect. So no wonder these substances like caffeine and chocolate give you a little bit of a boost. But it means when it comes to bedtime, your adenosine is not going to be at that same level. You're not going to feel as drowsy. So it throws your rhythm off, and then you can't get as good of a sleep. And it can also impact, you know, your what's called non-REM sleep, which is like the really deep sleep. So you're going to have impacts with that too.
And yeah, Lisa, a lot of our patients too are coming to us where they're already taking some sleep aids. Things like prescription sleeping pills and even cannabis. And there's a couple of things that is really important to be aware of with sleeping pills, even though, again, they're prescribed and they are sedative, they're not necessarily supporting a true sleep. They're not getting that deep restorative sleep that is really important. They don't help us, you know, especially in terms of our brain function, to even like consolidate our memories. And what's also really important to know of is even if you are just using those sleeping pills every once in a while, there is an associated increased cancer risk. And, you know, those health impacts really can take hold even if you're only using it like 3 times a year. So that's really something for people to be aware of and you know, something to look at some other ways of supporting your sleep. And this is where a lot of people are also reaching out for cannabis. What's really important to be aware of is more recent research is really suggesting that any cannabis that has THC, again, acts as a sedative, but it's not getting that deep restorative sleep. So it really isn't the best sleep aid. And when you stop that THC containing cannabis, you can get more rebound insomnia if you stop. So and create more dependence. For some people, it also increases, you know, paranoia. This isn't, and more of the recent research is suggesting that this isn't necessarily the case with cannabis that is just has the CBD in it. So again, CBD may help without some of those negative effects of THC. So that's something, you know, for people out there to be aware of.
For sure. Yeah. And even with the sleeping pills, I have patients who've come to me who have taken them, and it's scary because they can get up in the middle of the night and sleepwalk and actually sleep eat. And they have no recollection until in the morning they go into the kitchen and there's food out on the counter or the table. So it's definitely impairing our brain waves and, you know, what's happening in our brain. So their body is still moving, but they have no recollection of it. So it's not something you want to mess with. So hopefully the other recommendations we discuss will be more beneficial for you without the side effects.
Thankfully, there's a lot of other things that you can do to support your sleep.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Absolutely. So again, you know, what can wake you up? What can cause poor sleep? You know, again, those stimulants like caffeine, we talked about light and blue light, you know, before bed, but also, you know, in the night as well. Blood sugar imbalances can really kind of throw that off and again, kind of create more of that cortisol to be stimulated and wake us up too early or in the middle of the night. You also have to be aware of, you know, some medications can throw off your hormone balance and, you know, impact that deep sleep, that REM sleep. And we'll kind of talk more about that too, in terms of other nutrients and other herbs to be aware of. I mean, also what you do have to watch for is, again, the rest of your environment. your kids, your pets, your partners, maybe neighbors, all of, you know, extra sounds, especially if you tend to be a light sleeper and not in a deep sleep and spend less time in kind of your deep sleep part of your sleep cycle, then yeah, you can be impacted by your environment around you. And we can kind of talk about some of the things to think about to reduce those from happening too. But then there's also, you know, what else is going on inside? We talked about that balance of cortisol and melatonin. So if you do have extra stress, extra anxiety, things that are stimulating your adrenaline and your cortisol to be released, that can absolutely impact your sleep. Restless leg syndrome can also be an issue. Sleep apnea or snoring can also be a huge sign of issues with not being able to get a good deep sleep. But then there's other kind of irritating factors that you may be experiencing physically. Any kind of pain can throw you off. Skin rashes and itchiness can really interrupt your sleep cycles. Hot flashes, especially as getting into perimenopause and menopause, can absolutely be a huge piece that needs to be addressed in order to get a good sleep. And as well, are you waking up and going to pee, at least once a night? I even have patients that are getting up two or three times a night to go pee. So really looking at that and seeing, okay, what is the cause of that? Can I shift that so that I don't need to get up and pee? That can be really key for getting a good night's sleep.
For sure. Yeah, really great information, because you really want to hone in on what's interrupting your sleep. You want to have those base foundations, you know, supporting the cortisol and the melatonin, you know, helping that adenosine accumulate, but then layered on top of that are all these other causes. And then even something as simple as lowering the thermostat's really key, because sleep really does depend on the melatonin produced by your body, as well as the temperature dropping in your body by about half a degree or so. So setting your thermostat 15 to 19 degrees Celsius. I love using a Zonli weighted blanket. It has little glass beads, so it helps you feel cooler, even if you're getting some warmth or hot flashes, especially leading up to your period or in perimenopause, because that's been a problem for me, is feeling too warm at night. That's impacted my sleep, the stress and the anxiety, whether it's hard to turn off my brain to fall asleep, although I typically fall in the camp. If I wake up at, 3, 4 a.m., my mind's racing and I'm thinking about everything and processing so much. So those are kind of the two major causes for me impacting my sleep. And then I know, too much caffeine and too much alcohol, I'll be warmer at night. I'll wake up a lot earlier because your blood sugar actually dips too. And that can trigger the release of cortisol and throw your whole system off. But Tony, what impacts your sleep negatively? Oh yeah, and Stuart sometimes too. He's better now, but he was challenging sleeper, that's for sure. So yeah, that's a whole other, it feels like a whole other life, but that can be very disruptive and a really big challenge to work through.
For sure. And that's definitely something I had to work through with Frankie as well. And we'll kind of talk more about some things to think about when it comes to really helping to support your kids' sleep so that you can get a better sleep as well. But if your kids are sleeping, you better be able to sleep too. And I know for myself, alcohol can definitely be an issue. And this is where, we think of alcohol as being very relaxing. And sometimes people will think, okay, I need to have a glass of wine in order to relax and fall asleep. But alcohol is actually a sedative. So you're not necessarily getting a real sleep. It does kind of shift your brain activity and your cortex activity to kind of almost feel like sleep, but it's not. Often you'll get more of a fragmented sleep where you're waking up a lot, maybe not even realizing it, but you're not tapping into that restorative sleep. You're getting less time in that that REM sleep. So I know for myself that not only when I have some alcohol, there's that fragmented sleep that I get just because of what alcohol does to the body. But for myself, I know that alcohol will stimulate more of those hot flashes, which then again throws off the temperature piece. I definitely noticed that if I'm hot inside or if I've forgotten to turn down the thermostat at night, it will definitely impact my sleep. I will just wake up feeling, again, hot, sweaty, throwing the blankets off, putting the blankets back on. It's, you know, a real pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I hate those nights where I forget to turn the thermostat down because, you know, Pete seems fine with whatever temperature. He's a really good sleeper. But for me, I'm very sensitive to that too. And then talking about sensitivity, for me, I can't have caffeine. I usually stop drinking caffeine about 10 a.m. And then I have a little bit of dark chocolate after my lunch. But I know if I push that back or have a cup of tea after lunch or in the afternoon, I'm going to be impacted. So the half-life of caffeine is about 6 hours, which means the quarter life is about 12 hours, meaning there's a quarter of it left in your system after 12 hours from ingesting it. And for some people, as we get older, we can't process the caffeine as well. Our sleep is more fragile, as you said, Tony. And even our liver enzymes don't metabolize things as well. So it can impact the quality of your sleep too. You may not go into a deep sleep or you may have trouble falling asleep. So really, you know, analyze that as well. And if you are having urinary issues, bladder issues, things that can irritate the bladder include citrus, spicy foods, carbonated beverages, alcohol, sometimes coffee or acidic things in general, like tomatoes, for example. So looking at ways to prevent those wake-ups as much as possible is really key as well. And then I do love the idea of, you know, journaling before bed or just having a set time in the day where you're going to unload your worries. Because a lot of times as busy moms, it's like you're just survival mode throughout the day. You got to do this and this and this and this. You don't have time to think or process. So when you wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning to go to the washroom, your brain might start to process everything that needs to get done or wasn't done. So really scheduling even 5 to 10 minutes of worry time, of a to-do, writing down a to-do list, you know, ending it maybe with a few things you're grateful for can be really beneficial as well.
Yeah, and that's also where I found a real key for me is even scheduling some meditation time or some deep breathing time right before going to bed can really help to, again, quiet the mind and you know, kind of get me into a place where I'm, again, not thinking about, you know, work or things to do the next day, or, you know, all that list of things to do, you know, even for the week. That for me is really key as well. But also using some other, again, nutrients and herbs that can really help to support reducing that cortisol and supporting that relaxation before bed can be really key. You know, we've definitely talked more about, like, you know, teas and some of those nutrients to use before bed, whether it's chamomile tea or Tulsi tea or lemon balm. You know, that can be part of like a calming bedtime routine, you know, after, you know, turning off the screens and turning down the lights so that there's less stimulation of light. But also using essential oils. Sometimes people find lavender very relaxing. Some people can feel more stimulated with lavender. So even using something like cedarwood can be really nice. You can diffuse it in a room or, you know, mix it in a carrier oil and put it on your bottom, on the bottoms of your feet, or even, you know, putting a bit on a cotton ball or a Kleenex in your room can help to kind of diffuse that scent as well. So that can be really key. Also, you know, things like my favorite nutrient, which I'll talk a little bit more about, magnesium, can be really helpful for reducing that cortisol. Herbs like passion flower, GABA, or other herbs can really impact our GABA receptors, can really help us feel more relaxed. It really does kind of reduce that stimulation of the brain. You know, so even things like magnolia and again, lemon balm, chamomile can also be really great that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and adrenal support in the day can help too, using things like ashwagandha, for example, or other herbs. But you listed some great things that are commonly recommended, but you want to see your healthcare practitioner, your naturopathic doctor one-on-one to make sure it's right for you and safe for you. But my favorite go-tos definitely are magnesium. I do take a little bit of melatonin before I go to bed. At times of stress, I'll take some passion flower and GABA together, and I find that really helps to calm my mind. But it is about that sleep routine and having ways to unwind. And I know a lot of people fall asleep with the TV on, right? They might be watching TV or listening to a podcast. And as long as you're falling asleep, and then, you know, hopefully you're not falling asleep in bed to the TV, because then that's, you know, you're starting to associate watching TV with being in bed. But ideally you get drowsy on the couch and then you go upstairs. Hopefully you haven't quite fallen asleep, because you do want to train falling asleep to being in bed, but hopefully it's made you drowsy enough that you crawl into bed and fall asleep. But you want to be careful, right, with that association, because so many people I know do fall asleep on the couch watching TV for a long time, for maybe half an hour, 2 hours, they're snoring, and then they go to bed and they might have trouble falling asleep in bed because they're used to falling asleep on the couch, or they might wake up in the middle of the night because they haven't processed what's gone on in the day because they're using TV as like a passive relaxation, as I call it, like it's a way to kind of zone out. So then if you haven't unloaded your thoughts when you wake up in the middle of the night to go pee or for whatever other reason, then your brain can start to be processing a lot at that time too. So just being careful. And then even with the screen exposure, thinking about blue blocking glasses as well. And with melatonin, we get a lot of questions about melatonin too. A lot of people take too much. So you typically only need about 0.5 to 3 milligrams to help you fall asleep. If you take too much, you definitely can have more side effects, which could be grogginess in the morning, hard to get out of bed, maybe some really vivid or strange dreams. And melatonin's most studied with jet lag, or if people are doing shift work and they're trying to go to sleep when it's actually light outside and their cycles are shifted. But it still can help with the how long it takes for you to fall asleep, and even sometimes the depth of sleep. But we know it does also help with our immune function. It's antioxidant. So it's something to consider, but it's not for everybody. And if it doesn't work for you, well, you might have another reason why you're not sleeping. You may be making enough melatonin, but you might have other issues in the other areas we discussed. And as a side note, we'll talk about testing, but you can actually get your melatonin levels tested through the dried urine test for comprehensive hormones, the Dutch urine test. It measures your melatonin levels, which is fascinating. So I've seen a lot of people come up low and they think they're fine. So that's just a side note there.
Absolutely. Especially since, you know, there was an interesting study that looked at reading before bed, because we think, you know, reading again can be that nice, passive, relaxing activity before bed, but it makes a difference what you're reading. Are you reading a book with paper, or are you reading on an iPad or your phone or on a screen? Because one study showed that reading on an iPad actually suppressed your melatonin levels by half, by 50%, and it delayed the onset of sleep by, you know, even around 3 hours. So that's something to really look at. How are you supporting your melatonin levels? Are you just relying on taking a melatonin pill, or can you actually do things to increase your melatonin levels, what you're producing and what you're releasing by yourself? So that's also something to look for in terms of that light production, the light that you get during the day versus the light that you're getting in the evening as well. And people may not be realizing that.
Mm-hmm. I know. I think it's really overlooked, right? So tapping into those things that help boost your melatonin and help with that melatonin cortisol cycle is really key. And then as listeners, you may be going through some hormonal changes. And we know, as you know, with PMS, sleep can be worse for a lot of people if they're not getting that progesterone peak that they're supposed to after ovulation. As people get into menopause, as the progesterone and the estrogen drop, you know, the hot flashes, the vaginal dryness, sinus, urinary tract issues can be all disruptive to sleep. So looking at hormone testing, supports to balance your hormones. And we've talked about that through various other episodes. I think we actually did an episode on hot flashes, so we could link to that. So whether you're using herbs, supplements, bioidentical hormone creams, lifestyle changes, and nutrition, listen to that episode to get more information. But for some people, if that's the major disruptor of their sleep, that's going to be a game changer. And again, the Zonli weighted blanket, or if you have a favorite glass beaded weighted blanket, share that in our Facebook group, because that can help, and lowering the thermostat is really key too.
Absolutely. And again, so what kind of testing, what kind of investigations may make sense for you to really make sure that you're getting the best sleep? Or do you know that you're not getting a good sleep and you want to really get a sense of what will really impact your sleep the best? Like you mentioned, Lisa, I'm a big fan of the Dutch test that gives us an idea of what your melatonin levels are. It can look at what your estrogen, progesterone, testosterone levels are like, how they're broken down in the body, as well as your stress hormones. And again, those kind of looking at your cortisol hormones as well can be available through the saliva. But again, I find, you know, a urinary test like the Dutch or the Qi test is just really comprehensive. I know before when I've done cortisol testing myself, I'll never forget, I had decided that I was going to do it one particular night. I didn't really realize that it was the same night that the finale for Survivor was on. And I'm a big Survivor fan, you know, from a long time. So I've been watching this like reality show for years. Again, it was that piece of like watching the Survivor before bed. I think it was on at like 9 o'clock. So between 9 and 10, I was watching Survivor. I was really into it. It was an exciting show. So when I got my saliva hormone results back, and looked at those cortisol levels, my cortisol was had the normal peak of like peak in the morning, it dipped down in the evening, and then my sample right before bed had spiked in terms of that cortisol level. So that's where this kind of testing can kind of give us that idea of, oh, are you being too stimulated at night, or what other hormone issues are going on?
That's fascinating. Yeah. So you think about the types of shows you're watching. I like to watch boring shows because I'll feel wired up and harder to settle down. And then also if people work out late at night, and so many hockey teams, you know, they have ice time when rinks were open, scheduled 10, 11 o'clock. So no wonder people can't settle down. First of all, they're in bright lights. They're exerting themselves. They're taxing their adrenals at a time of the day when they're supposed to be unwinding. So in those circumstances, you know, if you still want to get your workout in, it's still is exercise, but something like a nice strong Tulsi tea that you've steeped for 10, 20 minutes after your nighttime workout. Hopefully you just watch a boring show instead of a stimulating one. But if it's the Survivor finale, have some, you know, Tulsi tea after. Hopefully that would help, right? So having a strategy to really actively unwind through meditation, yoga nidra, or other things as well.
Definitely. In terms of other testing, you can always look, if you are having more nasal congestion, which is leading to snoring, looking at food sensitivities or allergies can be important to look at. And I found for patients that can be really helpful in terms of supporting their sleep. If you're having, again, urinary issues, you may want to not only just reduce those bladder irritating foods, but you may also want to see a pelvic health physiotherapist and really get an assessment to look at muscular tone and look at, you know, specific pelvic exercises to really support you. And if you're having other types of pain, definitely I often will recommend seeing a physiotherapist or osteopathic practitioner, getting some imaging to really get a sense of, you know, what is happening with that pain, what's going on, and what is the best way to reduce that pain and really get that pain treated so that it's not interfering with your sleep.
Definitely. And then if you have a snoring partner, you may have heard the term sleep divorce, but more people are opting for this option because if your partner tosses and turns or they're keeping you awake with their snoring, commonly now people are sleeping in separate rooms. So they may start off the night having a nice cuddle and some alone time and then going off to their separate rooms to actually get their quality sleep. And then maybe they'll schedule having a little bit of cuddle time in the morning again. So they still have that connection and that contact, but they're getting a deeper sleep and then they're going to be in a better mood. They're going to be less snappy at their partner. Their libido is going to be higher, you know, in the day or in the morning. So that's something to consider. And yeah, if you have a partner who snores, there's definitely, in my opinion, nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of stigma around it, but as we saw and as we discussed over this episode, just how important sleep is. So figuring out a way that works for you and your partner is another option. And then having ways to tone outside noise that maybe you don't need to hear, like the barking dog outside, the noisy neighbor having their party. So you might use a white noise machine. I think, Tony, you have some strategies there too, or earplugs. But, you know, if you have kids, I understand you might need the monitor near you, but at least you could drown out some of the other sounds. But what do you like to use for the noises, Tony, in your neighborhood?
For sure, especially, you know, to really support Frankie's sleep so that the rest of us can sleep. I use both a white noise machine and just have the bathroom fan on because I can really, again, drown out those extra noises. If you have a partner that snores, again, sometimes earplugs are necessary, especially if, you know, if someone is snoring, whether it's you or your partner, it would be really, I really highly recommend getting a sleep study done with medical doctors, especially, doctors who are specially trained in sleep science. It's really key. But if that's not possible, yeah, you really need to kind of take care of yourself, use those earplugs or, you know, whether you put on a humidifier in your room or an air purifier for some extra noise. Or again, looking at, you know, doing some testing. The sleep studies with by doctors is the most accurate way of really looking at how you are sleeping, or, you know, are you waking up? What kind of sleep cycles are you getting? Less accurate is definitely using some of those sleep apps or an iPhone or that kind of thing. Even more accurate than those is using something like an Oura Ring or a Whoop strap that can kind of give you a little bit more accurate information without having to go to a sleep study to really get a sense of again, what your sleep cycles are like.
Yeah, there's so many cool ways to track things, but taking it with a grain of salt and kind of seeing the patterns over time, right? It's not that it's picking up on every single thing, but some of these apps like the Sleep Cycle app will pick up on you put your iPhone on your nightstand and you plug it in, you turn it on airplane mode, but it can pick up on your sounds and movements. Some people do put it on the mattress to pick up more of the movements, but it can pick up snoring and breathing. So it gives you some information. And I know people are hesitant about the sleep studies because they're like, I'm hooked up to all these wires. I'm in this environment that's not my own, but it will pick up on those medical conditions where it's, you know, pretty bad. It's going to pick it up. So yeah, you might not sleep as well as you would in your bed, but it'll still pick up if you're stopping breathing and what your sleep cycles look like. So it really is important to get that checked out because we know that sleep apnea is linked to increased blood pressure, heart attack, strokes, etc. So you really want to explore that too.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think we covered a lot of tips and tricks about what to do for sleep. Do you think we should talk about anything else before we go to the next part of the podcast, Tony?
Well, and even just, you know, a quick hack that some people can have, especially if you don't have the ability to, again, kind of cool down your environment, you can cool down your body as well. And sometimes having a warm bath or a hot shower can help you cool down after. It increases vasodilation. So that's also kind of a key trick that I like to use with Frankie as well, making sure that she has a nice warm bath to cool her down and make sure that her body's ready for sleep as well. well. So that's something that you can use for both yourself and your kids too.
Good point. And then we didn't mention, but not eating too close to bed, because that'll increase your body temperature as you're breaking the food down. We did talk about the alcohol consumption. That'll make you feel warmer too. And then just in terms of helping kids sleep. So yeah, I really like the Insight Timer app. It has some meditations and bedtime songs for kids. So we really like to incorporate that in Stuart's routine after reading a book and after having a bath. I do use a bit of, sometimes a little bit of lavender oil diluted in a carrier and rubbing it on his feet, but I'll share one of my mama must-haves after. But I think with kids, it's really helping them unwind, limiting their sugar, right? Even if it's seemingly not too much. Stuart was getting some of the Made Good granola bars after dinner, and they still have sugar, right? And that was really stimulating for him. So once we cut that out and moved to less sugar, his sleep did get better too. So that's been important for Stuart's sleep. So really setting the tone and quieting things down before bed as well.
Absolutely. I think that's such a key piece for both us as moms and our kids too. So Lisa, let's switch gears and let's go into the part of the episode where we get to find out about your supermom moment.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm really proud of myself because it was Mother's Day yesterday and I was like, well, what am I going to do? You know, like we were going to have a lot of fun activities as a family, but I thought, well, I need a little bit of downtime. What's something I haven't done in a while? So I actually took a couple hours in the afternoon and I drove down to a really nice beach called Cherry Beach here in Toronto, and it has a really nice trail. So I walked for about over an hour, and then I'd brought a book and a nice tea that I really enjoy. And I sat on the beach and I just sat in the sand and read some of my book and zoned out and just watched what was going on and listened to the sound of the water. And I came back really, really refreshed. So we had a lot of fun family time this weekend, but I really made a point to get some alone Lisa time, especially in nature. We can link to the episode of why you want to get into nature and to help lower cortisol and stress hormones, but that was really therapeutic for me.
That sounds awesome, Lisa. And again, it's funny because that's such a great way to not only improve your melatonin levels, but also your stress hormones. So that's fantastic that you really kind of, took care of yourself that way.
Well, thanks, Tony. And I know you're doing a great job, but is there any time over the last little while where there's been a bit of a mama mess up?
Well, yeah, especially again, talking about sleep, I've really got into a terrible habit. And I know that I'm not alone because, oftentimes when we put our kids to bed, it's like, oh, it's my time now. I want to, watch a show or do something, just for me. I really got into a bit of a rut with watching Netflix too late. Especially this weekend, with you taking care of yourself, I kind of accidentally stayed up until 1 a.m. The other night watching Netflix, watching a series and kind of binging it. The next day I really felt it because again, Frankie's going to wake me up in the morning. Just because I stay up late doesn't mean that I'm going to be able to sleep in. And so the next day I was just like not functioning as well as I know that I can. I was less calm, less relaxed. I was kind of more snappy. And then we went for a kind of a spontaneous Mother's Day road trip. And when we were going and again, Frankie had to go to the bathroom, we were in a town. So I was like looking around to see what kind of washroom was open. And I was just frantic and just not thinking clearly. My brain just was not functioning well. And thankfully, hopefully she didn't pick up on that. But again, our kids can really pick up on a lot of things too. So I felt bad about that. And even though, again, mama mess up, I definitely learned my lesson. When it comes to Netflix and watching a series, like check how many episodes that series is. Check how long the episodes are before I really commit to watching a certain amount or trying to finish a series in one night.
Oh, well, we've all been there. It's so fun at the time, right? But then now that we know, we are woken up at a certain time the next day, it's like, oh, that's why I don't do that too often. But it sounds like you were enjoying a show and you learned something from it.
Yeah, but that being said, time to get back to a reasonable bedtime so that I can really get a good sleep, not only for myself, but for everyone around me as well.
Nice.
Okay, Lisa, what other kind of mama must-haves do you have for this week, especially, around sleep?
Yeah. So I'll share two. So we were talking about teas before bed. With kids, it's hard to get teas in. You could make it into a popsicle or something. But another hack is to actually just put a tea bag or two of lemon balm or chamomile in the bath with them. So they breathe it in, it's steeping in the bath. So that's a good technique. We did that when Stuart was suffering from a lot of sleep changes and it did seem to help. And then I do like the Badger Sleep Balm. It's a kind of like a shea butter base that you can, it smells a bit like lavender. I rub it on the backs of Stuart's hands where his knuckles get dry from all the hand washing, and sometimes on his feet as well. So I find that's a good way to kind of get a little bit of lavender scent without it being too strong. But Tony, what's your mama must have?
Great. Yeah, my mama must have for this week is definitely some strategies that we use to really help to support Frankie's sleep, but even for my sleep as well. I'm a big fan of magnesium. And having a nice yummy magnesium liquid can be just really great. So we have a special drink at night for Frankie before bed that is a magnesium liquid. The one that we use is the Mag Matrix by Cytomatrix. It's a combination of magnesium glycinate, citrate, and malate. So it really helps to support the body to physically relax and mentally relax. So, and Frankie, again, I have a spoonful of it. She, takes it willingly every night. It's pretty tasty. So that is definitely my mama must have for this week, as well as the Bach Flower Rescue Remedy. It's a combination of different flower essences, so very dilute amounts of different flower essences put together. And they actually have a nighttime bedtime spray that you can use to just help to give you a little bit more gentle support to help to relax. So again, Frankie willingly takes it at night. And again, I use it before bed. But even, if either of us wakes up in the middle of the night, that can be an easy go-to to just do a couple of sprays to help to get more relaxed and fall back asleep easily.
I love those recommendations. I forgot about the Bach Flower Rescue Remedy. And yeah, we do love magnesium in the house, but we'll pull that one out. Thanks, Tony.
Oh, absolutely, for sure. So what's happening with you, Lisa? Is there anything that people should know about outside of again, your naturopathic medical practice?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm still, I have a wait list for my fall enrollment of the Wild Collective Toronto. In this 10-month virtual program as it is right now, we dive deep into hormones, into stress, into digestion and thyroid and more. But you can go to wildcollectivetoronto.com to get on the wait list, and then you'll be notified when I'm sending out more information, when I have the information session on it. So check it out. It's a great way to build connection, community, and sisterhood while getting an empowered health curriculum. And Tony, what do you have going on right now outside of practice and momming? That's a verb. I just made it up.
Well, in addition to momming, I'm teaching my next hypnobirthing info session this month. Lots of expecting parents are looking for ways to relax, relaxation, and really tapping into your instincts is really key for the most positive, labor and birth experience. So you can definitely find out more info on the website hypnobirthingcalgary.com.
Sounds amazing, Tony.
Thank you. And thanks everyone for joining us today. Again, we'll have our show notes on our website, perimenopausalmamas.com. You can check us out there. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love for you to subscribe, especially if you enjoyed this episode. Please leave us a review and a 5-star rating, and that helps other perimenopausal mamas to find us too.
Well, stay safe and healthy, everybody. Until next time.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.